On April 17, 2002, two U.S. Air Force pilots were told that if they did not take their go pills or amphetamines, they could be found unfit to fly in their mission over Afghanistan. So they took their amphetamines and flew their patrol near Kandahar. Believing they were being fired upon, the soldiers killed four Canadian soldiers and severely injured eight others in friendly fire. Now, Major Harry Schmidt and Major William Umbach are facing four counts each of manslaughter and dereliction of duty. Preliminary court-martial proceedings against the two F-16 pilots begin next month, and if convicted, they could face up to 64 years in prison. Their legal teams are questioning whether the amphetamines the pilots took played a part in their deaths. Are the drugs enhancing safety, or are they creating situations that are dangerous in and of themselves? Should the U.S. Army be giving soldiers drugs at all? Joining us to discuss these questions is retired Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, former vice president of the Center for Defense Information and a former Navy pilot who actually took some amphetamines himself on the job and says this is nothing new. We're very happy to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be aboard.
Well, I wonder if you could start by just giving us a little background as to your career in the military.
Yes, I joined the Navy during World War II and trained as a pilot, subsequently flew combat missions in Korea, and trained as a nuclear weapons delivery pilot throughout the 60s, commanded two aircraft squadrons, an aircraft carrier, and an aircraft carrier task force, so I feel quite comfortable discussing the issues of training and preparation for combat missions.
The big question that jumps out is the fact that I understand that you did use some amphetamines yourself when you were flying. Is that correct?
That is correct. And this was occasioned by the fact we were training for long missions to deliver nuclear weapons. I was flying a single-engine airplane where I was the pilot, navigator, and bombardier. And as a result, they were very stressful. When you return to the carrier after something like 10 hours in the air, oftentimes at night, you were beginning to get pretty bushed. And the flight surgeons, who followed this carefully, provided us with amphetamines to be taken shortly before returning aboard the ship to sort of pep us up and pick up our attention for the actual approach and landing.
So how long would you say that these amphetamines have been in use in the military, and how widespread is it?
Well, I know for a fact that they've been in use for 40 years. Flight surgeons, following the pilots and their operational assignments, do prescribe medicines for safety reasons. They're not to make killers out of people. They're to heighten their state of alertness and responsiveness.
So what is your comment on that in terms of the potential dangers of the use of these drugs among the military?
Well, clearly, if the pilots are being pushed so hard that they have to be put on these performance-enhancing drugs on a regular basis, yes, this is unsafe, not necessarily because of the drugs, but because of the stress on the pilots, which is cumulative. They just are going to get worn out and lose their perspective in some of these demanding situations. I think the proceedings which are coming up now are going to have to look very hard at this. Are we pushing people too hard? Are we demanding more of them than they can provide safely? The inquiry also is going to have to look very hard at this issue that I just raised. What were the pilots told about conditions in the area they were being sent to? Were they informed that there were friendly forces present and that they would be conducting exercises which could be mistaken for hostile action? It is my understanding, and I've consulted with some Canadian authorities on this, that the Canadian commander duly informed the area commander that this exercise was scheduled, that it would be going on at a certain time and place. And there's no reason that information should not have been conveyed through the command and control system to the airborne controllers and to the pilots themselves. Then their judgment would not have been tested. They would have been informed that there were no hostiles there, that this was a friendly fire situation.
And we are speaking with retired Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, former Vice President of the Center for Defense Information. We have been talking about the case of the American soldiers who accidentally killed some Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan. They are claiming that amphetamines played a role in their action. To take the situation to a larger arena, Admiral Carroll, what does this situation say to us in your mind about what may lay ahead for us when it comes to this possible war against Iraq?
War is fought in a fog. There's always ambiguous situations and always moments when the pilots, when the soldiers on the ground must respond without a full, clear picture of what they're confronting. In these ambiguous situations, these tragedies occur. I was director of U.S. military operations in Europe and the Middle East for all U.S. forces at one point. And had I been in charge in this circumstance, I hope that I would have promulgated the rules of engagement and the means of enforcing them so that these pilots would not have been confronted with a decision as to whether they were facing hostile fire. There apparently was plenty of information that should have been conveyed to them that would have protected them in this particular situation. So now looking to Iraq the second, these sort of lessons are going to have to be learned and applied, or we'll have exactly the same situations.
And as a gentleman who's had such a distinguished and long career in the military, do you feel that what's going on now with respect to the escalation of aggression in the world by the Bush administration, the preparation for attacking Iraq, is this an unprecedented situation in terms of the U.S. role?
It is, in my estimation, an illegal course of action. When you read the Charter of the United Nations, which we wrote, the only authority to authorize combat action, hostilities against another nation, is the United Nations under Chapter 7. And for the United States, Mr. Bush, to say, we reserve the right to preempt and to attack when we see a threat to our interests or security, is to say we disavow the Charter of the United Nations. And that is what is really troublesome. Now, is this something unique? I regret to say it isn't. Take a look at Panama under President George H.W. Bush. That was a totally illegal action. That was a total preemptive action for no justifiable or legal reason. Grenada under President Reagan. For what reason did we attack that tiny little island, which presented absolutely no threat to America's security? So it isn't unique, it isn't new, but it's been brought to a sort of a new level of significance because we did go to the United Nations in September 12th. President Bush made a very strong speech there, challenged the United Nations to act against what he presented as a threat to the peace. And after 8 weeks of really tough negotiation and strong U.S. leadership, the U.N. did exactly what we wanted them to do. The U.N. set up an effective, powerful, intrusive inspection regime, and Saddam Hussein, I think, was intimidated, coerced into accepting it. The U.S. position and leadership has been so powerful that we have actually brought about a legal means of resolving the situation in Iraq. But it does not appear that we can take yes for an answer. It appears that we are actively engaged in preparing to attack Iraq regardless of what the United Nations finds and reports on the 27th of January. We're sending a signal to the whole rest of the world that we will determine that we're the superpower, we will call the shots, and we will not abide by the UN Charter. That, I think, is terribly dangerous to the long-term security interests of the United States of America and to the safety and future well-being of my children and grandchildren.
Do you have a concern that if we do invade Iraq, that this could lead to a nuclear confrontation?
No, I don't think that's going to be an issue at all. Of course, the Iraqis have no nuclear weapons. We have no rational, moral justification, whatever, for contemplating nuclear war. What I do think it's going to lead to is we will defeat Saddam Hussein. We will decapitate his government. By the way, that's Pentagon language, a decapitation strike. And when we do that, we will have taken full responsibility for the state of Iraq. We need a state there. We need a central government maintaining internal order and external security. And who's going to carry that out? The United States of America. When we defeat Saddam Hussein, we will have really gotten into deep trouble. A former Secretary of the Navy, James Webb, a Vietnam veteran, a graduate of the Naval Academy, has said that the United States must think in terms of occupying Iraq for as long as 30 years. What a horrible position to put yourself in, to use your military power to take over a nation and then have to defend it for 30 years, knowing that terrorism will continue or be intensified. We will have alienated the entire Islamic world and certainly many of our closest friends and allies who do not support us in this aggressive posture. And we will become the sole defender and protector of the state we have just decapitated.
We've heard, Admiral Carroll, that there are divisions within the Pentagon. Do you think that a portion of the Pentagon does not support this war?
There are professionals in the Pentagon who know that what I just said is true. They're going to become the occupiers of Iraq. They're going to be wearing body armor in the desert in July and trying to survive ambushes and booby traps and landmines and snipers, and they don't have an idea as to when that will end. There's no end in sight because there's certainly no basis for an internal takeover by responsible Iraqi authorities. They're going to be fighting among themselves, not governing. There are Shias, and there are Sunnis, and there are Kurds. There are Iranian interests, there are Turkish interests, there are Syrian interests, there are Kuwaiti interests, all of which are going to come to violence in Iraq, and we're going to be stuck there, and the people in the Pentagon who are going to be stuck are opposed to it. They do not want to see us in this position. But the Bush administration is adamant. You have President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary Rumsfeld, the Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, a senior advisor to the Department of Defense, they're all pushing this idea that we're the superpower and we will call the shots and take over Iraq when we decapitate that government.
What do you think the real root reason is that we want to do this?
Now, I've been asked that question so many times, and I have to speculate on two things. One, Saddam Hussein is a threat to the peace if left undisturbed. There's a great deal of difference between controlling him and decapitating the government. That's where they don't draw the line. And they seem to want to do that in order to exercise our status as superpower, to use this massive military power we've built up. And the reason I infer for that is it's so profitable for so many people. Last year we spent $348 billion, and this year we're going to spend almost $400 billion on the military. And there are people getting fabulously wealthy off of this, and they're the ones who have the strong voices in the Congress, in the White House, in the Pentagon, who are pushing us toward a global hegemony based on our military power. This is what we're seeing in Iraq, is we want to dominate, not leave the maintenance of peace to the United Nations, because it justifies this huge military establishment. President Eisenhower warned us very thoughtfully and presciently in 1961, beware the influence, sought or unsought, of this new factor in American life, the military-industrial complex. He just forgot to warn us about Congress providing all the money for it and all of the people who are going to profit in the process.
Do you think there's any chance that we won't end up doing it?
There is no crisis with respect to Iraq. They have no means of attacking us, no means really of attacking their neighbors, as long as we are allied with them, and no weapons of mass destruction or means of delivering them, really. They may have chemical weapons, and they may have biological agents, but they have no means of waging war with them, nor any reason to do so. Why don't we stick with the United Nations? They're doing what we demanded, and let's try to resolve this problem of Saddam Hussein in a legal, nonviolent process. Can it be done? Yes, but let me point out that we're moving thousands of troops, we're moving ships, we're pre-positioning aircraft and war materiel. When we get that gun loaded, aimed, and cocked, we can't hold that position very long. We can't hold that condition. We're going to have to fire because preparations for war have a life of their own, a momentum of their own. And I'm afraid that we're already far down that road to when war becomes inevitable. Unless the American people really speak up and tell their elected representatives, the president, the Congress, that this is madness, going to war that will end up with the United States occupying the state of Iraq and facing the hostility of the entire Islamic world for as far into the future as you can see. This is the only way it can be headed off, is really the democratic process, and I'm pleased to be playing a part of it and that you're playing an important part by providing this information as part of the debate. Clearly, I'm presenting a point of view, and it can be challenged, but that's what democracy is about. And finally, citizens reach a decision and make their will known, and that could prevent an unnecessary, disastrous war in Iraq.
Retired Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, former Vice President of the Center for Defense Information, we really appreciate your being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.